Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood! This is your host for the most, Nikki Carulla. Eddie Pence is doing a comedy show tonight. We're going to jump right into this wonderful interview. We have in our studio Mr. Eric Robinson. Say hello, Eric.
Hello.
All right, our studio audience loves you already. Easy breezy. So, Eric, you and I have been friends for a long time.
Long time.
And I just can't wait to interview you because you've been doing so much cool stuff in music.
Thanks, man.
And the coolest thing, like I was saying, it's like I always get to know my friends even more in this 1 hour. So let's just jump right into it.
It's great.
I want to ask you, what was the first instrument you started playing? What was the moment of zen that made you get into music?
I started playing piano when I was about 4 years old. We had a small grand piano in my parents' house. And I
it's like
was
an oxymoron, a small grand piano.
Yeah, well, it was a baby grand. That's a better term. So I would reach up and play the keys, and I think I made enough noise that my parents finally said, "Oh, we should probably get you piano lessons because,
there's an interest.
There's an interest, but it sounds terrible. So you could learn to play, and then it will sound great.
Did you start with classical?
Playing classical music. So I started piano lessons when I was five. I probably took 5 or 6 years of classical and then started playing jazz around 10, 11.
That's awesome.
And played jazz from 10, 11 until 18.
See, I started playing classical music, but I started singing classical music, and I just got burned out on classical music. So I quit piano lessons around 10 or 11.
Yeah.
And all I wanted to do was play like blues and jazz and all that stuff. But it took me a couple of years to come back, and the Beatles were... That was the reason I came back to piano. What were you playing? Do you remember what you were playing?
Classical?
Yeah.
Oh, Chopin, Beethoven, Mozart.
I'm sure you played Bach.
All the standard stuff.
What about jazz? What about jazz?
I mean, standards. You know, I had one of the fake books, and I would just go through and I was in my high school jazz band, and I played piano, and I played some drums and some bass and that, and I loved it. It was great.
That's awesome.
I think it's for people like us, it's probably hard to kind of stay in one lane. Like if you start playing classical music, to just keep doing that. I mean, maybe if you love it.
I'm in awe of classical musicians for that reason.
For sure.
Man, you never steered the course. That's just it.
It's amazing. But I don't know, for me and maybe for you too, it's you start hearing other genres. You hear jazz, you hear R&B, you hear rock and roll, you hear calypso, you hear
it's exciting.
Country music.
Oh my god.
Oh my gosh, what is all this stuff? Like there's so many I don't know. They're not like languages, but they are kind of like languages.
Well, they're like vacation spots.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. Why wouldn't you want to visit London and Paris and Tokyo and,
So in your high school jazz band, were you doing like bebop? Were you doing Autumn Leaves? Were you doing Miles Davis?
We did a little bit of everything. It's about 20 years ago now. So it's hard for me to remember, but we played a lot of the standards. We did some big band stuff.
That's awesome.
We did some like rhythm and blues, like some James Brown sort of stuff. We had a really good horn section, so we could do. We did some Herbie Hancock.
Awesome. And where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Palo Alto, California.
Okay.
Palo Alto, Menlo Park. It's funny, everyone who's from Menlo Park says they're from Palo Alto.
Vice versa.
Ask Drew Holhurst about that. But I had a great time doing that. I also sang in the chorus, and you know, you did that.
Yeah, of course.
So I was very fortunate to get exposed to a lot of different types of music as a young kid.
And when did you find that, like, that love? Like, were you like, were you in it, and you were just like, this, these are my people, this is what I want to do? Or was there a moment where you like, oh my God, I have to do this. This is just, this is where I want, this is where I belong.
I mean, I loved it from a really, really young age. I was, the piano was a magnet for me. I just could not stay off of it. And then around sixth grade, when I was 12, I started playing guitar, and that was like crack. I Right. couldn't get enough of it. And then I sort of started playing bass a little bit and a little bit of drums. I couldn't get enough.
And you play a lot of instruments. You play pedal steel, I think, too.
I play lap steel. Yeah, I play mandolin. Right. I play accordion. None of them well. Just, right. you know, passive.
Just enough to do what you need to do.
Yeah, I can create ambient pads on all of them. No.
I don't know if you feel like this, because I just started playing the mandolin. I'm like, every time I pick up a new instrument, I'm like, why didn't I just spend years just learning every instrument known to man? You know what I mean? It's like, I've seen some musicians. There's one musician that plays with Paul Simon. He plays the cello, the banjo, the guitar, the bass, the drums, and then he plays horns. And like, dude, I'm like, you're crazy. I mean, that's just, I don't even know what you do with your time other than playing instruments.
There's some people who can just pick it up and, like, they say in Good Will Hunting, and I could just do it.
Yes.
There's some people who are like that. Like
Greg, I'm not one of those.
Yeah, like Greg Wells can just pick up something and just play it, and he's brilliant. But, you know, for most people, it takes a lot of practice.
Right.
And, you know, drums, for example, like I'm a crap drummer. Right. Okay. I mean, I can sort of play, but the coordination that takes for your four limbs to act in concert and to have pocket, I mean, that's something that it takes decades. Right. It takes 10,000, 20,000.
At least you know the verbiage if you want to talk to a musician.
Yeah, totally. I understand it, and I can play, quote unquote, but
do you have a favorite instrument?
No, I don't. You know, people ask me, you know, what instrument do you play, or what, you know, what's your main instrument? And I always say I'm really a half keyboard player, half guitar player. I don't consider either of them my dominant instrument. So that actually gave me a lot of opportunities when I was a sideman to play with people, because I wasn't sort of a keyboard player who could play a little bit of guitar, or a guitar player who could play a little bit of keys. I'm kind of equally proficient at both.
Hmm.
And I kind of enjoyed both of them equally. So, yeah.
And so when you graduated high school, did you attend a music school, or did you just kind of jump into just being in a band?
I went to USC. Our alma mater.
Yeah.
Fight on. In the process of figuring out, okay, well, I'm finishing up high school, what should I do next? I had spent a lot of my time during high school working in a recording studio called the Rikus Center, run by this guy, Gary Rikus, who I owe so much of my musical exploration and experience to. And
was he teaching you Pro Tools, tape, all of it?
Pro Tools. This was 1997 that I started working with him, and he had a Pro Tools 3 machine.
Hmm.
And it was run like a Quadra 950 or something like that, or a Quadra 650. And we had a 1.5 gigabyte hard drive.
Wow. That's limiting.
That was limiting. That's like having...
But at the time, you're like, we have 1.5 gigs.
Yeah. It's like we have 8 channels and basically like one reel of tape almost. So
that's insane.
Yeah. We didn't really comp takes of the full band. We would just record, and it was like, how was that take? Now we're going to do it again? Okay. Undo.
Wow.
I mean...
You didn't have the room.
Hard drives were so expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, $1,500 for... like a 1 gig hard drive or whatever it was back then.
That's anyway, crazy.
So he had a early Pro Tools 3 system, and I was super lucky to get my hands on one of those when I was 15.
Wow.
And to start to play around with that. And I immediately realized that producing and engineering, making records, was what I wanted to do. As much as I love playing music, I get greater enjoyment from helping other people, songwriters mostly, get their commitment.
Well, you
music.
Like the collaborative thing.
I like the collaborative thing. Yeah, I like the push and pull, and the you know, I like helping people. Truthfully, is you know, as much as I like playing music, I really enjoy listening, and I really enjoy helping people get the most out of what they're doing in a recording studio. So,
is there a record that like kind of changed your life, or is there a band that kind of made you go, okay, I want to know more about recording and production sure. and all of that?
So many, but probably Dave Matthews Band. Someone, you know, that we share in common.
Yeah.
But I remember the first time I heard Under the Table and Dreaming. And
that was the record that did it for me too, man.
Yeah, and the opening riff of Best of What's Around, boom, you know, just hooked like
crazy.
Me. That drum sound. Oh my gosh. And
the fidelity of the recording.
Yeah,
just I remember it had the same effect on me.
Yeah, so. It just sounded amazing, and especially at that point in time, it was right when I was playing jazz. So I was into I was really into saxophone, and I was really into guitar. It was like all the, and I was also into hip hop too.
Right.
I was really, you know, in Bay Area, we had a great local hip hop scene, and I was into Tribe, and I was into Lytyrix and all this stuff. And so it combined a lot of these elements, like the, you know, Carter's drums, very huge. You know, hip hop almost influenced.
Yeah.
You know, had a lot of syncopation. And, you know, if he played an electronic kit, he could almost, you know, play in Tribe or almost be Questlove. So I heard Dave Matthews Band, and initially it was just like, wow, this is, it was original. It sounded amazing. And the arrangements were
I think, you know, also because you were a musician, because like, I think for me, what drew me to them also was the musicianship. It was like, oh my God, these guys can really play.
Yeah.
They can really work together to create something as a whole. So you like, you heard every part. You knew everybody could play individually.
Yeah.
When they came together, you're like, oh my God, this is a band.
Yeah, you know? Totally. And I think, they're great musicians. And then on top of that, I really appreciated the fact that it sounded like a live performance.
Right.
There's so many times you listen to a record and you think there's no way that this was done live, or that if they got on a stage, the three, four, or five members of whichever band, that they could reproduce this sound, and you know, having listened to live recordings of them and then going to see them live, seeing them reproduce what they did on the record pretty closely was
Did you see them in close proximity to you discovering the record?
Yeah, pretty soon. My first show was November 9th, 1996.
Hmm.
And so I think I first heard
it. Was the Horde Festival, right?
No, it was at the Cow Palace in San Francisco.
Okay.
It was on the Crash Tour. I was a freshman in high school, and I went with like seven of my friends, and we had the best time. And it was a GA show, so you could, you know, it wasn't seated.
Right.
So
got there early.
We just pushed our way all the way up to the front and got crushed. But, I was 14 years old.
I have to ask you this because I didn't know that record was the one, and this just gets me so excited.
Yeah.
That feeling, I still remember, I was standing outside of a Blockbuster Music when I got the record Crash.
Mm-hmm.
When you first listened to that record, what kind of sensation did you have? Because I knew you fell in love with the band with Under the Table.
Because
I remember that moment where it was just, they were going in this direction that was like even more of who they were, and it was just...
That's a great development from Under the Table to Crash. It's sort of like whenever I work with a band, it's what I hope for.
Right.
Is you make a record like Under the Table, and then you make something that's even deeper and more layered and has different textures. It doesn't sound exactly the same, but it's
related.
It's related. Yeah. It has connective tissue, but it's. You know, I hesitate to say the word bigger because it's not bigger. It's just more, you know?
Yeah.
More.
And I, you know, like I read in your bio that you emailed Steve Lillywhite, who produced both these records.
Yeah.
Tell me what made you want to do that and how that all came about and what was the result?
So after high school, I went off to college. I was at USC. I was studying the music industry. And...
Which is tough when you are a performer and writer and hands-on, because industry's all the stuff that's kind of a little bit of a snooze fest compared to making music.
It's a little bit hands-off at a school like USC, and some of that's good because you learn a lot about some like contract law, and you learn about stuff that's not hands-on, but also I feel like at that age you really want to be hands-on.
Right.
Like you really want to do stuff. So... I was trying to figure out what I was going to do that summer, and I had this brainstorm. I said, what would be the coolest thing that I could do this summer? And I thought, well, Steve Lillywhite's one of my favorite producers. He did Dave Matthews Band, U2, Rolling Stones, yeah. Fish, you know, on and on and on. And Guster, oh man, Guster, love that record, Lost and Gone Forever. And I thought, well, the coolest thing I could do would be to go and work with Steve. So I sent, I somehow, you know, this is like the 2001, early 2001. And I sent him, I somehow found his email on the internet. And I sent him an email and just said, hey, my name's Eric. I'm a freshman at USC. I'm studying music. I love your work. And I've worked in studios for years. And I know how to use Pro Tools. And, you know, I'd love to come be your apprentice sometime this summer. And he wrote me back the next day and said, great to hear from you. At the time, he was doing a lot of A&R. He was over in London doing A&R for Mercury Records. So he said, I'm not in the States right now, but why don't you get started with my engineer, this guy, John Sickett, and he was the guy who recorded Crash with him, and they wow. did Lost and Gone Forever.
Wow.
And so he said, why don't you start working with John, and then I'll be in New York later this summer, and we'll link up and
And it was upstate New York. It wasn't like in the city, right?
Where I worked with them?
Yeah.
No. So it's a really funny story. So I connected with Sickett, and he said, okay, great. Well, why don't you come June 1st, and we'll start then, and come to Burlington, Vermont. And he gave me this address, and I didn't really know where I was going or what I was going to do. It was just, and I said to my mom, I said, I want to go do this. And she was super supportive.
That's awesome.
And just said, okay, great. And she bought me a plane ticket, and I flew to Burlington, and I hopped in a cab and went to this address and knocked on the door, and John Fishman opens the door.
Wow.
And he said, hey man, you're Eric. Okay, cool. And you know, okay, here's your room. Here's where you're going to stay. And, I was a Fish fan, but I wasn't like a Fish head. So, but I was a really big fan of Billy Breeze, the record that,
Lily
White and Sickett did, some amazing songs and amazing arrangements on that record. There's a lot of other stuff that Fish has done that doesn't really strike me, but that record in particular
is
cohesive, and there's
song oriented.
There's focus to what they're doing.
Yeah.
Lily White's really good at cutting the fat. So I had no idea I was coming out there. I was going to live at Fishman's house, and we were recording at Fish's studio at the barn. And so, one of the first records I did there was this Zydeco band called Swampadelica with Sickett. And then the next project that I did was Trey Anastasio's solo record.
That was the one that came out in 2002 or 3?
Yeah, like that. About that. I think it was self-titled.
Yeah.
So I worked on that for about a month with Bryce Goggin and Todd Voss. And Bryce is a really talented producer. He's
that was his first solo record, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so. That's when the band sort of broke up.
Yeah.
And so it was an interesting time. So people always ask me, "Oh, you worked with Fish?" And I was like, "No, I didn't really work with." I worked with
all, I was around them.
I worked on all the side projects. I worked on Page's side project for a minute. I worked on
was that Delta Blue or Nova Blue?
Vita Blue.
Vita Blue. That's right.
And I worked on Fishman's thing for a minute, but most of the time I spent with Trey on his project. And he had this really great band, this awesome drummer named Russ Lawton, and Jen Hartswick on trumpet, and Tony on bass, and just an awesome live band. And they have this beautiful studio that's a 100-year-old barn that they disassembled from a different location and then assembled on this sort of mountain, not on the top of this mountain, but like on this hill with this gorgeous view. And so it's this tall barn with probably 35-foot ceilings, and it's about 60 feet long.
And is it like all hardwood floors? Like, does it look like a studio and all that inside?
No, it looks like a barn.
Wow.
It's a 100-year-old barn.
Wow.
So just the place is very organic. And, you know, the floors are like I believe are the original floors.
Wow.
But, you know, it has some interesting, it has this metal staircase that goes out, and there's like a cupola in the top that you can go up to. But it has an amazing API console. I think it's still there. For a while, it seemed like they were closing it down, but I think it's still there. Amazing API console, a ton of gear. So I worked with Trey for about a month, and I actually lived for that project. I lived at the studio.
That's crazy.
And it was awesome because on the weekends they wouldn't work, and I don't know how, if I should really say this, but
you're like sneaking into
Trey's,
the room.
Trey's guitars would just be lying around there, and I'd get to like play Trey's guitars. And when I tell that to my friends who are like fish heads, they
and he's got like some weird instruments.
Yeah,
they're so custom made guitars.
They're custom made guitars by this guy Paul Languedoc, who is their longtime sound man, and they're unlike anything you've ever played. I mean, it's kind of like a PRS, you know, semi hollow body.
Yeah.
But the
reacts
pick,
a little bit different.
It
right?
reacts differently, and the tone's really interesting. And you know, he uses what's his head? It's like a Mesa Boogie Mark II, Mark III, something like that.
Yeah.
And then he has this these custom cabinets, so it's a really unique rig. But I was.
Remember what he was using for his overdrive?
Oh.
Because he's got a really distinct like pedal sound.
I think he was into the TS-808s.
Okay.
Not the tube screamers.
I
think it was the tube screamers. Okay. But I was super lucky to kind of fall into this.
Yeah,
but
totally.
And I tell the story all the time to encourage people to say, hey, you know, if you have a dream scenario, go after that. Like so, when I thought about it and I emailed Steve, I made a list of like, okay, this was my first choice, second choice, third choice, and I had a list of a bunch of the other producers that I really liked that I wanted to work with: Brendan O'Brien, Rick Rubin, you know, people like that, who probably would have been much more difficult to, maybe it would have happened, but Steve was at the top of my list, and he was the first person I emailed, and he replied, and I worked with his engineer for about 2 months, and then came into New York, and worked in New York, and watched Steve mix U2, and...
Which album was it? Was it the Atomic Bomb one?
No, it was a live DVD, live from Boston.
Okay.
And, you know, Steve is... sort of like an otherworldly character.
I've met him. He's like an alien.
He's like an alien, yeah. I mean, he's a genius, and he, I don't know, he sort of levitates above the fold.
Yeah.
He's out of this world. So, yeah, it was a really special experience for me at that age, at 19. And it's funny, I can actually trace every single thing that I've worked on back to that's one
crazy.
Opportunity. Everything started with that. I can even something that I like a band, like a rock band that I worked with last week, I can trace back through relationships to that experience.
That's amazing.
And when people ask me about, oh, how should I get started? I always tell them, try and get started in the ecosystem that you see yourself working in.
Yeah.
If you want to work on R&B records, don't go and work with people who are doing folk records.
Yeah,
if you want to work on pop records, don't work with people who do metal records. Like try and get into the fold, because you know it will, your world and your
it becomes your universe.
Yeah, your universe will open up. You know where you pretty much where you start. I mean, there's some people who are able to change sort of midstream, but for the most part, you know, relationships develop organically. You know this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so my work sort of started there.
What was the coolest thing that you learned from Steve Lillywhite? I know it's hard to just like narrow it down, but there has to be one thing where you're like, I can't believe that I'm in this room right now.
The coolest thing I learned, you know, honestly, there's so many Lillywhite philosophies. One of these was actually from Sickert, who had worked with him a bunch, who told me this beforehand, before going in to work with him. But it was the coolest thing. And that was, by the time you get to mix the record, and this is if you're recording the record too, there should only be one decision: how loud the vocal is. Mm. And I love that.
That's awesome.
I love that.
Yeah.
Because basically the way that those guys worked was that the whole time they were making a record, they were mixing, and they were committing to sounds. And you know, back then it was tape machines or a dash machine and a console. And you know, they would make extensive recall notes, or they would print reverbs on you know, other tracks. And so all along they were building the sound and building the sound and building the sound. And by the time you got to the end, literally,
it was pretty much done.
If you do it right,
yeah,
it's just how loud's the lead vocal.
Right.
I love that. I think it's great. In this day and age with Pro Tools and, you know, basically unlimited undo and unlimited tracks, people don't commit to sounds and decisions the way that I wish that they would. And
I also find that with younger artists too, it's more of a it's an uphill battle, because it's like those guys that make those epic records, they're epic for a reason, and trying to kind of like show that philosophy to the auto-tune generation, or you know, like they're not hearing it, they want it to be perfect because everything is so edited now. It's like showing them it doesn't need to be like that. It's like a different world. It's like
So, you know, when I record and mix an album, if I'm producing or if I'm not producing, I wear a bunch of hats, and sometimes it's all of them and sometimes it's one of them. But if I'm doing a full record with someone, I am building the whole time. So if I'm tracking drums, I'm adding compressors and EQs, and I mean, I try and track the drums kind of how I want them to sound, with room for, you know, if I want to make the snare have more pop later on, I'm not going to compress it so much that I can't get that to happen. But all the while I'm, you know, adding reverb and adding things and spacing and getting it to sound. I mean, hopefully by the time the band comes in and hears the first take, they're hearing a really good representation of what the record's going to sound like. And it's one of the reasons why I really like tracking with a live band. And, you know, that sort of happens less and less frequently these days. So many people are sort of siloed. You know, I have a lot of friends who have their own studios now. It's like, so, you know, this drummer has a studio and, you know, send the tracks to him and he'll play on them. Send it to the bass player and he'll play on it. And sometimes that's great, because sometimes you can get people together who are in different parts of the world or parts of the country. But to me, there's nothing better than having a group of people in a room
and
you know, doing a take and then coming in and listening to it in the control room, because on headphones, it's different. You have your mix.
There's also an energy. There's something about the chemistry of the energy of the moment.
It's
all
communication.
Of those
things. It's a musical conversation. You know, I love the interplay, you know, people looking at each other and talking, hey, what are you doing on the four of that beat? Okay, you know, the drummer and bass player talking, the drummer listening to the how the singer's singing, where the punctuation is, so to speak. You know, I'm really into working with great drummers and people who listen to the singer, because I think that the syncopation and the rhythmic elements of a track in relation to the vocal is something I really listen to.
All music comes down to, you know, rhythm and voice.
Yeah.
So it's like, if those two things are connecting, you know, you have all the other stuff can fly.
Yeah. You know? I mean, melody, lyric, you know, syncopation, performance. But, you know, back to what we were talking about, I love to get as close as possible, as early as possible, so that, you know, also so you're getting on the same page as the artist. And I try and communicate with people and say, hey, is this what you're hearing in your head?
Right.
Or do you hear it differently? Because, like, we're making the record right now. And try and, you know, make rough mixes and listen to stuff and, you know, in my car or on smaller speakers. And, you know, sometimes it's background music. Oh, hey, is that lead line, is that communicating, or is it too far in the background? One of the things I always try and think about is, like, the top line of a song. And sometimes, you know, it's covered in different sections. Like, sometimes in the verse, like, a guitar will be playing the top line, and the chorus, the piano will take over.
Right.
If the top line is communicating, sort of, even if it's at a low level, like, are you understanding the melodic story of the song?
Well, like, gives it density.
Yeah,
it has moving parts that are kind of echoing some of the same stories or ideas.
Yeah. So if you want to play a track,
yeah,
I was gonna say that play the Milk Carton Kids track Michigan. This was a record I did in 2011. And it's a very bare bones record. Two guitars, two guys playing two guitars, and two guys singing. I'm really proud of this record for the reason that we did the whole album in 3.5 days.
Wow.
And
mixes and everything?
Everything.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
And look, a big part of that was the fact that those guys came in with really great songs, with really great arrangements, and it was really about capturing the best possible performance. So, in a way, it made my job easier. But we really went after a very specific sound. But to me, this is one of my favorite things when you can go in with great musicians. And these were all live takes. And I mean, I almost could have mixed this straight to two track.
Wow.
I mean, basically, like, there was, I recorded this 24-bit 96K, and the mixes are pretty much the faders at zero. Like, it was, everything was EQ'd and compressed into Pro Tools. And then.
So you're just getting levels, basically.
The mix, you know, there were some rides and stuff like that. And you know, figuring out, okay, when they're singing at the same time, you know, how are the vocals panned, right, so that, and you know, basically it was really just like, how wide should the guitars be, and how wide and or narrow should the vocals be, and then there's one reverb on the whole record. And wow.
And how many takes did it take for you to get this track?
I think this was one of the ones where we recorded it at the beginning, and then we came, and I thought we could do it, I thought we could get a better take, and we came back and did it again at the end. I can't be certain for that, because this is about 8 years ago.
No problem.
But most of these songs we did five takes or less. Wow. And
that's a sign of a good band. That's what I like.
They're, yeah.
All right, here's the Milk Carton Kids with Michigan.
Took do now without you? Without you. Michigan's in the rear view now. Keep your hands where I could see them. You took the words right out my mouth.
I don't know what just happened, but it just cut off.
That's okay. It's a very long song. It's 5.5 minutes.
Okay.
But that's awesome. Thanks, man. I'm really proud of that song. I mean,
so
that,
beautiful.
Thanks. That's one of the, I feel like the best examples of anything I've ever worked on where we recorded it. It sounded exactly like that. They came in from the booth, played it back from them. And then, and that's what it was.
And it's two singers.
Yeah. Joey, Ryan and Kenneth Pattingale. And they're, I mean, they're both amazingly
It sounds
talented.
Very Avett Brothers, but like a little bit more organic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love the feel of it. The cool thing about it, thanks. It's like, every part of that, the guitars, the voices, even the reverb, are like characters in this. So, like, it just all breathes, it all ebbs, it all flows. It's really a fantastic mix and recording.
Thanks.
What are these guys? Are these guys still at it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, nominated for, I think, 2 Grammys.
Fantastic.
On Sunday. And they've had a couple nominations in the past, and they're on tour, and their latest record, they finally did a full band record. We did the first record, and I really wanted them to do to add one more instrument for this for the second album. But they wanted to make continue a very stripped down sound, and you know they sort of I like to see. And I really love when bands like grow a little bit, and they're finally doing the thing. They're finally like growing and expanding the sound. But it's so good when it's just the two of them. It's it's hard to, you know,
it's core.
You don't want to ruin something that's great,
right?
So it's a delicate balance. But you know, this is one of the things that I worked on that I always love to listen to because it was great. It was just they, you know, I sort of got out of the way. My job was just to capture a great performance and to encourage them and say like, you know, I think you can do it better. There's this one part here, but you know they came in really well rehearsed.
Right, that's always the best.
Yeah, I wasn't starting. We weren't starting from zero.
I think it's crazy when any artist or band goes into a record and they're like, okay, let's just start writing. I'm like, what?
Yeah,
that's crazy to me. You know, so it's nice when you see a band that's like polished. Have their act together, know the songwriting's there, know the arrangement's there.
Yeah, everything.
And they can just use the studio for it being the instrument that it is.
Yeah, everything was written. I don't really think we changed, like, hardly anything from what they had when they came in. It was more of just, what's the best, how can we make the best possible sounding version of this?
The thing about, I was excited about this interview. I was like, what 3 tracks is he going to pick? You know what I mean? Because you've done so many things and they're so different and they're vast. You've done pop, you've done indie, you've done folk, you've done rock. I was like, what's he going to play? This is going to be crazy. Great first one. I love it. I mean, I'm singing Ja praises.
Thanks,
so,
man.
So after you did this huge internship with Lilla White, you started a studio partnership with a friend of yours.
So, a brief interlude. So I came back from New York, Vermont, and because of that experience, I got a internship at the studio called Royal Tone that was in North Hollywood. I interned there, I became an assistant there, and then I became an assistant engineer. And so the whole time I was in college at USC, I was working at Royal Tone pretty much, my sophomore, junior, and senior years. And even a little bit after I graduated. And so I had a very different college experience than most people. Most people...
You're already in it.
Yeah, were, you know, partying and you know, going out with their friends. I would go to class in the morning, and then I would go to the studio.
Wow.
And I got to be a fly on the wall for a lot of great stuff. And then I also got to work. I took a year off, actually, in between my sophomore and junior years and just worked at the studio because I was having so much fun.
That's awesome.
And I'd been promoted to be assistant engineer, and I was getting to assist on a ton of records and work with producers that I really loved, like Ron Aniello and Mario Caldado. And it was great. I worked on a Bare Naked Ladies record. You know, Royal Tone, it was an amazing place. So many great artists coming through there. So that was kind of my college experience. And then after that, I spent three and a half years there. And then after I graduated and that had sort of run its course and I felt like, okay, I'm ready to go independent, I put in my notice at Royal Tone and left, and I went independent, which I soon found was really, really hard. And I was...
That's really where you got your legs.
Super broke and super hungry. And I had a studio in Santa Monica, a small place, and was trying desperately to you know, get people in there. And it was really tough. It was very, very hard. I didn't have an appreciation for how hard it was going to be. And then our mutual friend, Todd Carey, who had been producing and recording and mixing some of his albums in college, was going to do a new record. And he had asked me, yeah, who do you think I should work with? And I made a couple suggestions. And then he said, what about Marshall Altman? I said, oh, man. Mark Broussard Home, one of the greatest recordings I've ever heard in my life. I mean, I don't think anyone can argue with the fact that that track sounds unbelievable.
Is he from New Orleans or is he from here?
Mark's from New Orleans.
Yeah, I know Mark's from New Orleans. What about Marshall?
Oh, Marshall's from LA. Okay. Yeah, although he lives in Nashville now. So he said, what about Marshall? And I said, oh, man, I know that he's going to be good because you can tell that he really pushed Mark, because I had seen Mark play live a bunch of times, and Mark's one of the best singers on the planet.
Yeah, he's great.
He's amazing. But you can tell that from listening to from Marshall's productions, that he is really good at encouraging artists and pushing them to be their best. And from the moment that the vocal comes in on Home, rolling down the road, going nowhere. I mean, you can tell that there's the thought put into the performance and the arrangement
and the mix.
Oh, man, everything. It's an epic song. And so he ended up meeting with Marshall, and they were going to make a record. And then Todd said to Marshall, hey, I really want my friend Eric to work on this and in some capacity. And Marshall said, no. Just flat no. Right. And I remember Todd calling me and saying, sorry, man, it didn't seem like Marshall was that into it, but why don't you just come by the studio one day and just hang out? And so they were tracking it, Track Record, and the band was Aaron Sterling, Ben West, who else was playing? Jonathan Aarons, and Todd. Yeah, I think that was the band. And Nika Bolas was engineering. And I remember walking in and just being blown away by the sounds that they were getting. And I could tell that Todd was really, like, Marshall was pushing Todd in the direction that I always hoped he would go. Into focusing on the songs, into focusing on the lyrics. And it was great. And at some point, Marshall and I just started talking. And then we never stopped talking. And then, I don't know, very quickly, a couple days later, I was working on the record, and I ended up recording sort of all the overdubs and everything with Marshall. And we finished that record, and then we worked together pretty much every day for 5 years, and we had a studio together. The next record that we did was Kate Vogel's record for MySpace Interscope, which did pretty well. And then the next record we did was Matt Nathanson, Some Mad Hope, Come On Get Higher was on that record.
Yeah.
And so we were kind of off to the races, and it was a really fruitful relationship that continues to this day. Even right now, I'm still making records with Marshall, even though he's in Nashville.
And he just pulled up the LA scene. He was like, I got to go to Nashville.
You know, around 2010, he wanted to change not only for himself and work, but also for his family. And, I don't like to speak for other people, but I mean, he's my brother. I'm pretty sure that he would say the same thing. He was just ready for a change. And, you know, at that time, Marshall's also a songwriter, and there's a deep, deep songwriting community there. And we had gone out there to make one or two country records, and we recorded at Blackbird, and that was amazing. And, you know, he just made the move. And it was a real bummer for me to lose my partner in crime. But it was also great because it allowed me to spread my wings a little bit more and to work on stuff by myself, like the Milk Carton Kids record. And I started doing some records with John Alasia and did some stuff with Ryan Tedder and Dan Wilson and Mike Elizondo. And
all the heavy cats, man.
Great people. I was really fortunate, and it all goes back to that first, the email to Lily White, and working with Sickit and all the opportunities that came from that. But it was kind of the right time. It was kind of the time for me to sort of spread my wings and produce on my own, and I had a great time and.
Tell me about this Carrie Brothers track, because I know you were playing in his band for a little bit.
Yeah, so. I met Carrie around 2007. I played in his band. We toured together a little bit. Carrie was, I think, the first person. He'll tell you this, too. The first person who ever brought me on tour. He likes to claim that. And that's he awesome. Also would only bring me, he would call me up to go out and play gigs that were really fun. He'd say, like, hey, do you want to come and play in the Hamptons? Like, of course. Yes. I want to come and play in the Hamptons.
I think we did a gig together. We... it was a NACA Nationals?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember that.
So he would always call me when there's fun stuff. And, you know, he's a really close friend. And
he's famous for being on the Garden State soundtrack.
Yep, for Blue Eyes. Yep. And, you know, and if you turn on TV, you're bound to hear one of his songs played right. on. He gets so many songs synced. You know, he's just a sync machine. And so, you know, we've worked on stuff over the years, and the track that I sent you is a track that we co-wrote and with Justin Glasgow, and Glasgow and I produced it together. And yeah, it's one of my favorite things I've ever worked on.
All right, let's hear it. This is Carrie Brothers, Kick the Can.
Fate plans.
That was awesome, man.
Thanks, man.
Beautiful. I love the 6/8 feel. Like you really, I love when songs you really hear it in 4, but you can also hear it in 6.
Yeah,
you
we like split it. When we were writing this song, we had this vision for okay, there's going to be sort of like one half, and then the there's going to be two parts.
Yeah, it shifted. Love that.
Yeah, that was a really fun track to write. Justin Glasgow co-wrote, produced that with me. He played the drums and the bass. I played the guitars and the keys.
Love the guitars.
And thanks.
So good. And the keys. I loved it all, really.
Thanks, man.
But the guitar part, it's like, anytime you got that U2 kind of delay, reverb-y, I'm just like, I'm a fan.
I stole that from Michael Chavez. He taught me everything.
He's a badass too, man. He's a badass. Let's talk about this next track, because we're running out of time, and I could do a 10-hour interview with you.
I know, man.
Tell me about this song, The Lightning.
So this is a new band, friends of mine, Chris Pooley, Ginger Pooley, Max Bronstein, and Bernstein, sorry. This is probably one of the most recent things I've mixed. So I played Milk Carton Kids, which is from like 8 years ago, right. Carrie, which is from 3-4 years ago. And then I did this a month ago, and they just released it. And this is just a track I mixed. And I wear different hats. Sometimes people call me and just want me to mix. Sometimes people call me and want me to produce and mix and record and play instruments. And, but yeah, I love this track. They sent it to me, it was the first track that we did together, and also just completely different style. It's like a real indie rock band.
Awesome.
So thought I'd bring something that was kind of different from the other two.
Here's The Lightning, I Am Woman.
Yeah.
Man, what a killing way to just wrap up this interview. What a killing track, man. That Thanks. Groove is going to be echoing in my brain forever.
Cool.
Real quick, where can people find you if they want you to mix a track, produce a track, play on their record, etc.?
So you can go to my website, eric-robinson.com, eric-robinson.com. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. My handles on all are ericrobinson24. But usually, yeah, people go to my website and email me from there.
And that's R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N.
Correct. Right? Robinson.
Just got to spell it out because people are dumb. Yeah. Eric, this has been a fantastic interview. We're going to have you back.
Thanks, man.
You're going to have to come back in about 9 or 10 months, man. This was an incredible interview. So we wish you the best.
Thanks, man.
And yeah, man, keep making music, doing what you're doing because it's awesome, man.
Thanks, Nikki.
Awesome. We'll see you guys next week. On behalf of Eddie and myself, thank you guys very much. See you next week.